KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
North Oakland.
Temescal.
Alamo Square.
I live in Noe Valley.
Corona Heights.
Western Addition.
Coming up, what do the Lyft and Uber IPOs mean for drivers?
We felt like it was almost a slap in the face that they're cutting our rates at the same time that they're preparing to make millions.
Then we look behind the scenes at how tech is shaping our lives in ways we can't always see.
These algorithms, they don't show up randomly. They show up when there's a really difficult conversation that people want to avoid.
And when getting out of prison means being deported and separated from your family.
That's pretty much my life. Every time I think of my freedom, it's just focused all on my children, you know.
A story from Solano State Prison and more coming up on Cross Currents. The rideshare company Lyft recently launched its public offering, and Uber is expected to do the same this month. Some drivers on those platforms are taking this opportunity to tell both the companies and the investors that they're getting organized and want to see improvements in their working conditions. The group Gig Workers Rising formed last year to help drivers self-organize on a volunteer basis. Its members want investors to know that they could pose a liability to the companies if conditions don't improve. KALW's labor and economics reporter Liza Veal spoke to a driver, Rebecca Stack, and asked her what the IPO launches mean for drivers like her.
There's been grumblings for months that both of these companies were going to launch their IPOs. And what that meant to us is that there's going to be a lot more millionaires at these companies, right? There's going to be a lot of employees or founders or executives who are going to become even richer. And we felt, as a driver community, as the ones who are out there every day providing this service, we felt like it was almost a slap in the face that they're cutting our rates at the same time that they're preparing to make millions. And so we saw it as an opportunity to stand up and push back before this happens again. We've had our wages cut significantly several times over the last several years, and enough is enough.
Tonight, rideshare company Lyft is preparing to make its multi-billion dollar Wall Street debut, but the company's drivers aren't taking the news lightly, many now hitting the picket lines.
So some Lyft and Uber drivers went on strike before the Lyft IPO. Was there any response from that made you feel like there was any measure of success, or was that a disappointment, or is it too soon to tell?
In the organizing world, it's pretty realistic to know that one action or one strike is probably not going to bring about all the changes that you wanted to see right then and there. But we still believe that the strike was successful for several reasons. One, people are paying attention now, right? It goes out not only and reaches drivers that we may not be able to reach via our traditional methods, but it also talks to the general public and to investors of what's happening and what the reality is of their Uber and Lyft drivers. For example, when I have a conversation with a rider and I tell them that sometimes Uber and Lyft takes upward of 90% of what they're charging the passenger, they're shocked. There's a lot of passengers out there who think that drivers get the majority of the fare that they're being charged, which is just untrue.
So, like, what's your response to the idea that this company has never been profitable? In order to become profitable, it has to either raise prices, or they have self-driving cars, or cut drivers' wages. To you, does that seem like there's any room for negotiation when that's their response?
I'm not really sure how to answer that. But what I do know is that something has to change now, right? And if they're on this course and hedging their bets that it's okay that we continue to squeeze the drivers because by the time they are fed up enough and quit, we'll have autonomous cars to fall back on. I think that's a pretty risky bet to hedge. Yeah, I think it's risky for them.
So you've been organizing with Gig Workers Rising pretty much since they got started, right, last summer. And I know that most of the work so far has just been bringing drivers in, building your membership. But what campaigns have you, or has Gig Workers Rising, been focusing on?
believe it or not, when you talk to drivers, we're split on a lot of issues. But one thing that we found that we were not split on was their deactivation policies. So in gig work, deactivation is equivalent to an immediate firing. And because we're independent contractors, they don't have to give a reason. They can, you can just go to work that morning, log on in your car, and realize you've been deactivated for something. And the process that you have to go through as a driver to get reactivated is very arduous and long and very unclear.
Why would the platform deactivate you for no reason?
Passengers have learned to game the system and get free rides, that if they lie about something the driver did or their ride, then they get a refund. We have no chance to, you know, recourse to give our side of the story.
Right. So last October, Gig Workers Rising gathered almost 3,000 signatures asking Lyft and Uber to change their deactivation policies. But when you went to protest the policy and to deliver the petition to Uber's headquarters, a security guard tackled one of the drivers.
Yeah, I believe that made national news at the time.
So I know that Gig Workers Rising isn't focusing on a campaign around this specifically, but one big looming issue is whether drivers should be considered employees rather than independent contractors. So what would that change mean for drivers and for the company?
Well, the way it stands now with the independent contractors, we're responsible for taxes. It shifts all the risk to the workers. So Lyft and Uber, they're not responsible for any sort of employer-financed health care.
Or even making sure that drivers are getting minimum wage, right?
Correct. So it really reduces their overhead and removes any risk or liability from the company. Of course, their concern is if we're already not turning a profit and we now have all these additional expenses that we must pay, how will we then ever make a profit?
Right, which is why both Lyft and Uber have put up a big fight to keep their drivers designated as independent contractors. But here in California, that's all about to change.
The court decision sets new definitions for independent contractors.
And so now lawmakers are beginning to put that state Supreme Court decision into action, which Lyft and Uber drivers are split on this issue, right?
So those that are for something like this will say, I can finally have peace of mind and that I have a guaranteed wage and that there is some sort of profit in there for me. Now, drivers who oppose this are concerned that if we do become employees, they're going to lose the flexibility. If you're a single mom, or maybe you're going to school like I was when I had first started, and you depend on the ability to log on and off that app. What they're concerned about is that if we become employees, that Uber and Lyft are going to dictate when we can and can't work. I think that if drivers and these companies and legislators can all come to the table, I think there's a solution out there that you can still have a flexible gig economy for independent contractors while ensuring that they're paid fairly.
Liza is KELW's labor and economics reporter. You can reach her at economy@KELW.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. So it's been 10 years since Uber launched, just about 12 years since the very first iPhone came out, and 15 since Google brought us Gmail. All the technology that's come into our lives in the past decade or so has changed things in ways we can see and in ways we can't. Our next story comes from our friends at 99% Invisible. They're looking at what computer algorithms are doing behind the scenes in the day-to-day encounters we have.
On April 9th, 2017, United Airlines Flight 3411 was about to fly from Chicago to Louisville when flight attendants discovered the plane was overbooked. They tried to get volunteers to give up their seats with promises of travel vouchers and hotel accommodations, but not enough people were willing to get off.
Can't the pilots drive to Louisville? Can't they rent a car from the president?
United ended up calling some airport security officers. They boarded the plane and forcibly removed a passenger named Dr. David Dow. The officers ripped Dow out of his seat and carried him down the aisle of the airplane, nose bleeding, while horrified onlookers shot video with their phones.
No, this is busted his lip. Oh my God, look at what you did to him! Oh my God.
You probably remember this incident and the outrage it generated.
The international uproar continued over the forced removal of a passenger from a United Airlines flight. Today, the airline's CEO, Oscar Munoz, issued an apology saying, quote, "No one should ever be mistreated this way. I want you to know that we take full responsibility and we will work."
But why Dr. Dow? How did he end up being the unlucky passenger that United decided to remove? Immediately following the incident, some people thought racial discrimination may have played a part, and it's possible that this played a role in how he was treated. But the answer to how he was chosen was actually an algorithm, a computer program. It crunched through a bunch of data, looking at stuff like how much each passenger had paid for their ticket, what time they checked in, how often they flew on United, and whether they were part of a rewards program. The algorithm likely determined that Dr. Dow was one of the least valuable customers on the flight at the time. Algorithms shape our world in profound and mostly invisible ways. They predict if we'll be valuable customers or whether we're likely to repay a loan. They filter what we see on social media, sort through resumes, and evaluate job performance. They inform prison sentences and monitor our health. Most of these algorithms have been created with good intentions. The goal is to replace subjective judgments with objective measurements. But it doesn't always work out like that. I think algorithm design may be the big design problem of the 21st century, and that's why I wanted to interview Kathy O'Neill. Okay, well, thank you so much. So can we start, can you give me one of them sort of NPR-style introductions and just say your name and what you do?
Sure. I'm Kathy O'Neill. I'm a mathematician, data scientist, activist, and author. I wrote the book Weapons of Math Destruction: How Big Data Increases Inequality and Threatens Democracy.
So we'll start with the most obvious question. What is an algorithm? At its most basic, an algorithm is a step-by-step guide to solving a problem. It's a set of instructions, like a recipe. O'Neill's main point is that algorithms aren't really objective, even when they're carried out by computers. This is relevant because the companies that build them like to market them as objective, claiming they remove human error and fallibility from complex decision-making. But every algorithm reflects the priorities and judgments of its human designer, and algorithms are basically black boxes. In many cases, they're designed by private companies who sell them to other companies, and the exact details of how they work are kept secret. Right now, it seems like, because of algorithms and math, it's just a new place to place blame.
I would go one step further than that. I feel like, just by observation, that these algorithms, they don't show up randomly. They show up when there's a really difficult conversation that people want to avoid. Oh, they show, like, you know, they're like, oh, we don't know what prison is really for. You know, let's have a way of deciding how long to sentence somebody. We introduce these silver bullet mathematical algorithms because we don't want to have a conversation.
In O'Neill's book, she writes about this young guy named Kyle Beam, who takes some time off college to get treated for bipolar disorder. Once he's better and ready to go back to school, he applies for a part-time job at Kroger, which is a big grocery store chain. Kyle was such a good student that he figured the application would be just a formality, but he didn't get called back for an interview. His application was red-lighted by the personality test he'd taken when he applied for the job. The test was part of an employee selection algorithm developed by a private workforce company called Kronos.
70% of job applicants in this country take personality tests before they get an interview. So this is a very common practice. Kyle had that screening, and he found out because his friend worked at Kroger's that he had failed the test. So most people never find that out. They just don't hear back. And the other thing that was unusual about Kyle is that his dad is a lawyer. So his dad was like, what were the questions like on this test? And he said, well, some of them were a lot like the questions I got at the hospital, the mental health assessment.
The test Kyle got at the hospital was called the five-factor model test, and it grades people on extroversion, agreeableness, conscientiousness, neuroticism, and openness to new ideas. It's used in mental health evaluations. The potential employee's answers to the test are then plugged into an algorithm that decides whether the person should be hired.
So his father was like, whoa, that's illegal under the Americans with Disability Act. So his father and he sort of figured out together that something very fishy had been going on. And his father's actually filed a class action lawsuit against Kroger's for that.
The suit is still pending, but arguments are likely to focus on whether the personality test can be considered a medical exam. If it is, it'd be illegal under the ADA. O'Neill gets that different jobs require people with different personality types, but she says a hiring algorithm is a blunt and unregulated tool that ends up disqualifying big categories of people, which makes it a classic weapon of mass destruction.
The problem is that these personality tests are not carefully designed for each business, but rather what happens is that these companies just sell the same personality test to all the businesses that will buy them.
O'Neill also says it's important to measure the broad effects of these algorithms and to understand who they most impact.
Everyone should start measuring it. And what I mean by that, it is relatively simple. And this might not be a complete start, but it's a pretty good first step, which is measure for whom this fails.
Meaning which populations are most negatively impacted by the results of these algorithms.
And what is the harm that befalls those people for whom it fails? And how are the failures distributed across the population? So if you see a hiring algorithm fail much more often for women than for men, that's a problem. Especially if the failure is they don't get hired when they should get hired. I really do think that a study, a close examination of the distribution of failures and the harms of those failures would really, really be a good start.
That story was produced by 99% Invisible and edited for radio by Vika Aronson. You can hear a longer version of that story and more at 99pi.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Henat Baba. Next up is a story from Uncuffed, our series at Solano State Prison in Vacaville. With help from our team, the men there record interviews and edit them into short pieces that we play for you here on KALW.
This is Uncuffed.
Stories from Solano State Prison.
When undocumented immigrants are released from prison, they often face deportation. Charles Joseph, who was born in Fiji, says that is what will happen to him. He spoke with Uncuffed producer Joe Kirk, who's also incarcerated.
When he was younger, Charles Joseph's father was incarcerated and deported. With no father figure around and an overworked mother, it led him down a path that eventually landed him in prison. During his incarceration, he has went through extensive lengths to rehabilitate and change himself so he may be a better father figure for his family, because he worries that without himself around, his children might fall down the same path he is on, continuing the vicious cycle that affects so many families today.
All right, so today we're going to be talking about deportation, about how you're going to be deported after prison.
Yeah, and, I have a immigration ICE hold.
So I understand that when you were younger, your father was deported as well, correct?
Yeah, I came to America when I was 15. And not too long after that, he got arrested and was put in deport, you know, in INS. And man, that's where everything started.
So you kind of, after your father's deportation, you kind of went on a downhill slide?
Yeah, I mean, my dad was, he was the guy, he was the, he's the one that kept everybody in check, you know, especially the boys. So me being the oldest son in America, man, there was nobody that could control me after he, you know, after his, you know, separation from the family, being incarcerated.
Does the father play a very important role in Fijian culture?
Definite. Father is the head of the household. You know, all the decisions, all the everything. Disciplinary is the direction, you know. Man, I was a smart kid. I was getting good grades. I've always got good grades in music. I speak a bunch of languages. Everything is through my father's encouragement, you know. He teaches everything. He keeps everybody basically in line.
So with your father's deportation, you didn't have that anymore?
It was a big void in my life, you know, and then it was at the wrong timing, too, going through, you know, being a teenager. So that caused me to just act out, man, starting with school, you know, being bullied. I ended up just turning on my bully and beat the crap out of him and ended up getting expelled from school, Cappuccino High School in San Bruno.
How did you feel when your father wasn't coming back to America and you knew that you just knew that he wasn't coming back? How did that shape your life?
Man, that had a big effect on me. Being the oldest son in America, man, I felt the weight of the world fall on my shoulders. You know, for my little siblings, for my little brothers, for my sisters. All I remember is my mom working all the time. She's always gone, trying to work, trying to provide for us.
Now, you're going to be deported possibly, and do you feel that's going to have an impact on your children?
Definitely. I mean, I do my best to continue writing them, drawing pictures, and calling them on that 15-minute phone call, you know,
yeah,
with constant interruption, but that's only going to go so far, you know. It's important to be there physically, to watch their steps, to guide them, you know.
Do you feel that if you are deported and you're not around, that your children might fall down the same path you're on?
I fear this. I fear that my children, without having me present in their life, that they, you know, that I wouldn't be there to guide them through certain paths in life, you know. Help them with things that they will face. And especially now knowing what's out there, being a first generation here in America and seeing the gangs, seeing the drugs, you know, the peer pressure, it's different. It's different out here.
Yeah.
My parents didn't understand these things.
Do you believe you need a second chance or you deserve one?
I definitely feel I deserve one, you know, and I deserve not just for me, but for my kids, you know?
Yeah.
Man, that's pretty much my life. Every time I think of my freedom, it's just focused all on my children, you know? It's on my kids, how I can influence them positively and help them go about life.
That was Charles Joseph speaking with Joe Kirk. Joe is a producer in KLW's radio program at Solano State Prison. It's supported by the California Arts Council and the Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. The producers fact-check content to the very best of their ability. All content is approved by an information officer. You can listen to more stories from Uncuffed at our website, klw.org/uncuffed. And you can also hear Uncuffed and all the other stories and interviews that you hear on Cross Currents. Just subscribe to the Cross Currents podcast. Get it wherever you get your podcasts. This music is by The She's from San Francisco. They're performing at the Rickshaw Stop tomorrow night. Today's Cross Currents team includes Janae Darden, Lance Gardner, Priya Mahadevan, True Gwynn, Marissa Ortega Welch, Jessica Plachik, Marco Seiler Gonzalez, Andrew Stelzer, and Eli Wertschafter. Our engineers are James Rollins, Tariq Foda, and Gabe Graben. Content manager is Shirin Adil. Our managing editor is David Boyer. Deputy news director is Angela Johnston. News director is Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Bala.